This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Today we're going to be talking about colorectal surgery and all of the rather various illnesses and problems that may be needed for with Dr. Mark Kimmons. Dr. Kimmons, along with Dr. June George, run the Alaska Colorectal Surgery Organization. Their office is near the Alaska Regional Hospital on the Alaska Regional Campus. Dr. Kimmons is joining me in the studio. He was trained primarily in Canada, where most of his undergraduate and medical training and initial surgery training all took place at Queen's University, Kingston Hospital in Ontario. Then he moved to Seattle, Washington, where he was a fellow at the Northwest Colon and Rectal Clinic, and spent a couple years after that, as their program director there and on the instructor staff at the University of Washington before moving here. He's been in Anchorage, I think, a couple of years. Dr. Kimmons, welcome to Line One.
Good afternoon. Very pleased to be here.
You know, a lot of times I think it's worthwhile that we take a brief second and just step back and hear again or learn what it takes, the time and experience that it takes to really go out and set up a shingle, so to speak, about being a surgeon. So would you take us kind of briefly through your training and hit the highlights of what's important?
Yeah, I sure would. In order to become a surgeon, you have to attend 4 years of medical school prior to surgical training. And prior to that, typically you'll do a four-year undergraduate degree. So after you complete your undergraduate degree and your medical school, you then apply to undertake a surgical residency program, which is a 5 or 6 year program where you specialize in a surgical management of diseases of the abdomen, primarily in my case in general surgery. And then after I completed my surgical residency program, I then went on to complete subspecialty training in colorectal surgery for 1 year.
When I think of it, I trained over 30 years ago, I guess. Now, if I could sit down and get a pencil and a piece of paper and a calculator and think back that far, general surgery was a pretty well-established specialization. But now the whole issue of general surgery is being subspecialized to some degree. I think of vascular surgeons and colorectal surgeons. Why is that necessary? Why is that happening?
I think there's multiple factors to explain the increasing subspecialization within general surgery, and I think really part of the issue is with the name general surgery. Once upon a time, it was truly general surgery. It encompassed everything, including some orthopedics and some gynecology and some urology, and basically you were either a surgeon or a non-surgeon. And then as specialty knowledge was acquired in each of those areas, different specialties separated, such as orthopedic surgery and urology and neurosurgery, cardiac surgery. And then the same thing is now happening within what is traditionally called general surgery. In the United States last year, approximately 80% of residents in general surgery chose to complete some type of specialty training after general surgery.
So most surgeons go through a general surgery residency and then subspecialize after that.
That is currently correct. In fact, there are so many surgeons branching off general surgery that there is currently somewhat of a push to revamp surgical training to take that reality into effect. And it does pose challenges in communities who are hoping to attract a true general surgeon because there's a diminishing number of those surgeons who do everything.
Let me be a little bit more specific also. When I was being in training, I thought of a general surgeon who really did a lot of gastrointestinal surgery. They did colorectal surgery, or at least colon surgery in my mind. What is it that has driven the fact that now you have to be really, really good or subspecialized just to do that versus being a general surgeon? Although I think it's quick to point out, there may be general surgeons still doing some of those kinds of surgeries, but usually in less populous areas of the country, I guess I would think.
I think that's true. And I think, again, there's more than one factor driving the trend towards subspecialization. part of it is that with more and more scientific research and accumulation of specific data and knowledge in individual areas, that you just need more time to understand all that is known in a specific area. And secondly, there are health outcomes data and evidence that shows with increasing volume in a certain area of surgery and increasing specialization that the health outcomes tend to be better. One of those areas happens to be rectal cancer surgery, which shows that if you do high volume surgery, and particularly if you practice at a center where high volume surgery is being done, that health outcomes tend to be better. So that tends to promote specialization and expertise in certain areas.
So the more you do something, the better you get at it.
That's exactly correct. And I think for the general surgeon to acquire enough specialty and volume in every single area that is still under general surgery is not possible. Mm-hmm. So that is why there are certain operations which I never performed during my general surgery training, and I hadn't even experienced once until I went into colorectal surgery fellowship training. Mm-hmm. And I think it's partly a volume situation. Certain conditions are not very common. In order to get the volume and expertise needed to treat it proficiently, you need that extra training and experience.
So when did the colorectal specialty really branch off or become a very important issue? Has that been around 30 years, or has it been the last 10 or 20 years?
It's much longer than that. Interestingly, the American Society of Colorectal Surgery and the American Board of Colorectal Surgery is one of the oldest medical subspecialty boards, and it predates many of the other specialty boards. At one time, the specialists in that area were known as proctologists. Mm-hmm. So going back more than 40 years, there was a proctology society, mm-hmm. and that referred to expertise and management of diseases of the anorectal area. Mm-hmm. And that has subsequently come under the auspices of colorectal surgery.
Okay. Let me just remind our listeners that if you've got questions or comments today about our topic, colorectal surgery, you can get a hold of us a couple of ways. You can call us locally at 550-8433, 550-8433. That's between now and a little bit before 3 o'clock. We'll be here live. There's a rebroadcast, as you might know, at any time at KSKA.org. Go to line one on that website, and you can listen to the podcast at any time. Also, you can call us toll-free, 1-888-353-5752. And you can reach us by email during the program again at line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at KSKA.org. Well, give us an overview of the common disorders, diseases, problems that you're dealing with on a week-to-week basis.
Okay. Well, as the name implies, a colorectal surgeon is a specialist in the diagnosis, evaluation, and management of diseases of the colon, rectum, and anus, and additionally also the small intestine. And so the common diseases that I would see in the clinic would be the big colorectal diseases such as colorectal cancer or inflammatory bowel disease. I would also see patients with problems relating to diverticular disease, whether that be just diverticulosis or diverticulitis. Colorectal surgeons also manage the more common and benign conditions of the anus and rectum, such as hemorrhoids, anal fissures, perianal abscesses, and fistulas, as well as pelvic floor disorders, giving problems with bowel movements and function of the pelvic floor.
Okay. There's a number of areas there that I know I would like to get into, and we have some emails ahead of time that we'll address. But I want to talk about a few things perhaps related to colorectal cancer first, and then we'll move into that. And one of the first thoughts that comes to my mind that I don't think we've really ever talked about is what exactly, specifically, is the role in the decision-making process that the surgeon goes through once he is had a patient referred to him or a patient ends up in his exam room that has colorectal cancer? What do you do then? What happens? And then particularly I'm interested in the thought process once you get into surgery, and how do you know before you go to surgery what you're anticipating?
Right. Well, the primary role of the surgeon in colorectal cancer is the resection and removal of that cancer if possible. So the primary decision-making once the diagnosis of colorectal cancer has been established is to, first of all, determine whether the patient is a surgical candidate, whether they're fit to withstand the fairly significant risks and hardships of major abdominal or pelvic surgery. So once you've determined that that patient is a surgical candidate, you will try and determine whether it is feasible or possible to resect that malignancy. And if it's feasible or possible to resect that malignancy, how much of the function, normal function of that patient, you can either preserve or restore through reconstructive techniques. So nowadays, a lot of that decision-making will be done with preoperative imaging, such as CAT scans, transrectal ultrasounds, or MRIs, which will help the surgeon determine the extent of the disease and answer some of the questions as to whether it's resectable and what type of surgery will be necessary.
So the imaging techniques, I would think, have gone a long way to helping you anticipate what you're going to be doing. I would think before some of the fancier imaging or newer imaging techniques, you might go in and find out there's nothing you can do and you have to back out and you really don't do anything, whereas now that would probably be less common or less likely.
That's absolutely correct. I think exploratory laparotomy is the process by which a surgeon would go into the abdomen to explore and find out whether the operation was possible or to potentially make a diagnosis. And I think the situation where a surgeon would go into the abdomen and be surprised by the extent of the disease such that they would have to stop the operation or perhaps decide another operation was indicated would be much less common. The advanced imaging techniques are very, very helpful nowadays.
This may seem like a simple question, but it dawned on me while thinking about this. When you open an abdomen, you're going in, you're going to be dealing with a colon cancer. How easy is it to determine where the cancer is, just visually?
Well, for a colorectal surgeon, we typically know where the cancer is before the operation based on imaging and colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
So colorectal surgeons will often perform preoperative colonoscopy themselves, so they will have visualized the cancer through the colonoscope, a type of long, flexible camera. And depending on the technique employed for surgery, whether that be open surgery or laparoscopic surgery, if you go in by open surgery, you'll have a good idea based on imaging and colonoscopy where the tumor is. And then usually with the aid of your hands, you can identify the tumor by palpation or direct feeling with your hands. If you've chosen to do the operation laparoscopically, operating with the guidance of a camera inserted through a small port and small operating trocars, oftentimes either the colorectal surgeon will tattoo the lesion inside the colon colonoscopically, or one of our gastroenterology colleagues, if they have found the cancer, they are very good about knowing to tattoo the lesion so that the surgeon can see the tattoo through the wall of the colon when they go in laparoscopically. So usually finding the cancer is not the main issue.
And cancers feel differently, obviously.
They absolutely do. One of my surgical residents once exclaimed to me that cancers look and feel bad, and they thought that was kind of interesting. They thought, you know, of course it's bad because it's a bad disease, but the fact that it looks and feels bad is interesting. And they are usually obvious, but not always, and that's why the tattooing and other visualization techniques can be helpful.
What do they feel like?
They tend to be hard. They tend to be firmer than normal soft tissue if you touch the palm of your hand and touch the soft, fleshy part of your hand. That's what normal tissue feels like. And if you had a hard pebble or a lump under that skin, you'd feel that firmness or that nodularity, and that's typically what they feel like, firmer.
Cancers, and I assume the same is true of colorectal cancers, have a tendency to what we call metastasize. That means cells disseminate through the lymphatic system, bloodstream, to various other places. Is metastasis difficult, and what is the role of looking for metastasis at surgery?
Well, metastasis is very important with any cancer because the ability to spread throughout the body is what makes cancer a cancer. In fact, that's part of the definition of a malignancy, is it has that possibility to do that. And like any cancer, colorectal cancers can metastasize through lymph nodes and blood vessels and go to other parts of the body. With some of our more advanced imaging techniques, such as a PET scan or positron emission tomography scan, we are having increasing ability preoperatively to determine the presence of small metastatic lesions. But intraoperatively, we will visually inspect and feel all quadrants of the abdomen to try and determine the presence of metastases, because that will significantly change how the patient is treated postoperatively, and it also changes prognosis. Part of colorectal cancer surgery involves taking the lymphatic and blood supply of the region of the colon affected. Part of the reason for doing that is not only to remove any micrometastases or small metastases that are present in the tissue, but also to allow the pathologist to analyze that tissue in detail to determine if there's any metastatic cells present, because if there are, that usually is an indication for the patient to have what we call adjuvant therapy. And adjuvant means in addition to. So they receive, in addition to surgery, treatment with chemotherapy or radiation after the surgery typically.
Does it still occur that during the surgery some lymph nodes are given to a pathologist outside of the surgical suite to quickly do a frozen evaluation, a frozen smear, to see if some of these lymph nodes are involved that may not be, or to look at a margin, have you got enough of the tissue or the tumor and so forth? Is that still done?
We absolutely do that. In fact, I did it the other day. We were doing an operation, and there was a nodule present that was distant from the area of the colon that we were turning our attention to. And if that nodule had been malignant cells, that would have changed the operation. So yes, in that case, we would immediately take what we call a fresh frozen section. We take a portion of that nodule and send it immediately to the pathologist, who is able to look at that tissue under the microscope and report back usually within 10 or 15 minutes to help guide us in surgery.
I would envision that there must be some difficult decisions to be made, despite the fact that now it's easier and there's less decisions with all this preoperative preparation and scanning and seeing if we can identify where there may be metastasis. Give us some examples of difficult decisions you face during the surgery, something that has to be done now. You certainly don't want to close up and have to come back and do something different. So I'd like to flesh out this idea of what's some of the more difficult decisions made at the time of the surgery nowadays.
Well, those still occur. And when you go into an operating room with a patient with cancer, your primary goal, if possible, is to cure their disease. And if you can't cure their disease, you have to try and respect their comfort and dignity and preserve as much of their function and comfort as you can. So occasionally we will go in and be surprised that there's more extensive disease, and it is a very fine balance between trying to be as aggressive, and the term heroic is used, to do as much as you can do while at the same time balancing against the fact that this may not be a curative situation, and occasionally it is better for the patient to leave everything alone and pursue treatment such as chemotherapy or sometimes no therapy, which potentially will give them a longer and better quality life than being as aggressive as possible. So that's definitely one example of intraoperative decision making. Another one will be cases where a tumor is invading another organ, and the decision comes to be whether you will resect that organ en bloc connected to the cancer, which is the correct way to proceed if you are going to attempt a cure, or if the judgment is that this is so extensive that taking other normal organs out, it won't necessarily prolong life or increase comfort. So,
okay. I really want to discuss that some more, and particularly how much you might go through this discussion with a patient prior to surgery. But before we do that, I think I'm going to take a short break and remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Get away and stay in AK at the University of Alaska Southeast in Juneau. Join the UAS Residential Learning Community. Study glacial climate change, marine mammals in their natural habitat, or archaeology on land first inhabited by coastal Alaska natives. Start your life adventure at UAS. Details online at uas.alaska.edu/future. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is Dr. Thad Woodard, and you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Mark Kimmons, and we're talking about colorectal surgery. If you have questions or comments or experiences you'd like to share with us, why don't you reach you? You can reach us at by calling 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can dial 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email us at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, as one word, at ksk.org. Dr. Kimmons, so those kinds of decisions, I suspect, must be discussed with the patient before in a broad sense. I guess you're saying, you know, sometimes we see unexpected things, and I want you to be aware that at the time of surgery, these kind of decisions have to be made.
Absolutely. I mean, I think preoperative counseling is absolutely critical in order for the patient to go into the major surgery feeling first that they understand. I mean, it's their body and it's their experience. And so as much as possible, I would try and share with them exactly what to expect and to understand the type of situations that may occur. And I will try as much as possible to ask the patient what their wishes would be in certain situations, because there are patients who really want you to be as aggressive as you can, almost no matter what that means. So for that particular patient, longevity of life may be the most important factor, whereas for other patients, loss of function or living in an anatomically different way than they did before may be something that they wish to avoid. And so I would try and gain an understanding as to what the patient would want and then sort of go through the process of educating them as to what we might expect in surgery.
Okay. I had an email prior to the program that I'd like to summarize briefly and just get your comments on it. And this was a gentleman who, it sounds like several years ago, had colorectal surgical cancer. He was a little surprised afterwards, but certainly relieved that the cancer seemed to be taken care of, and it appears subsequently has. But he was left with some sexual dysfunction. He doesn't mention specifically what that is. And he's been a little bit remiss about and perhaps embarrassed to come and talk about it. He's also not certain who he should talk about with that. So would you address a couple of things? One, how does sexual dysfunction as a complication may occur with gastrointestinal surgery? Where should he turn for help in seeing if he can rehabilitate some of this problem that he has right now?
Well, sexual dysfunction is a possible side effect of any major pelvic surgery, and it's predominantly with pelvic surgery because you have pelvic autonomic nerves, and these are both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves that are responsible for normal sexual function. And when a surgeon is dissecting into the pelvis, there are sacral nerves, hypogastric nerve, preaortic plexus of nerves that are sympathetic nerves that are responsible for sexual arousal and ejaculation. And then there are parasympathetic nerves that are responsible in men for the erectile response. So there are numerous possible sexual difficulties that patients can experience after major pelvic surgery. And the classic one would be rectal cancer surgery. In addition to the significant dissection in the pelvis, there are often preoperative treatments with chemotherapy and radiation, which can have sexual side effects as well.
Okay.
So I think it's important for any patient undergoing rectal cancer surgery to have a full understanding that that is one of the side effects. One of the advances in colorectal surgery over the last couple of decades has been an appreciation and an understanding that preservation of normal anatomic and surgical planes is important not only in helping cure the patient of cancer, but also in helping preserve normal sexual function. And a technique known as total mesorectal excision refers to a sharp dissection in the fascial planes of the pelvis, which not only improves cancer outcomes, but also helps lessen the incidence of damage to those nerves, which I mentioned before. So there are things that can be done surgically, but the truth of the matter is the pelvis, particularly the male pelvis, is a very tight, bony space with not much room. And if you are having to go into that space surgically with retractors and other surgical instruments, those nerves can be damaged.
Well, it obviously, or to me, raises the question, is that's one of the reasons for the subspecialization is now you have people that are doing this over and over and over again. They're more up to date. They do the procedures more. So I would hope that those side effects are less. They're never going to be zero. Is there evidence to support that kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely. Right. There's actually good evidence to show that for rectal cancer particularly, there's less morbidity and there's better cancer outcomes when you are seeing a specialist who has higher volumes.
And one of the problems, I guess, that just comes to my mind about dissection you're talking about, well, sometimes this tumor is wrapped up around a lot of important organs that it's not like just taking things out willy-nilly. It's fairly easy. That may be very difficult to get the normal tissue and the abnormal tissue apart.
And that's one of the things we counsel patients, that if a tumor is invading a nerve, then the nerve has to be taken in order to help cure the patient with cancer. So,
and where would this person go? I'm suggesting a urologist is?
Absolutely. That's correct. So one of the advances medically over the last few years has been with the erectile dysfunction drugs, the common ones being Viagra, Cialis, or Levitra. Mm-hmm. And these drugs are used quite extensively in men who've had rectal cancer surgery or pelvic surgery that have sexual dysfunction. And for many of those men, if there's any preserved normal nerve function with the addition of some of these agents, they can achieve improved sexual function, and a urologist would be the person to go and see for that.
And just to be thorough, there may be other rehabilitation-like things that can be done besides these drugs if this individual maybe has tried these drugs and not being successful.
Yes, absolutely.
There may be other options.
Absolutely. There are other options other than those drugs, and again, a urologist would be the person to get advice from.
Okay. Michael, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Well, I just caught the conversation. I'm up here visiting, and I'm actually a urologist, and I had called in about another question, but he addressed a very important topic, and I was going to just ask one preliminary question here. Are they doing robotic surgery for low rectal carcinomas and having some of the good results that we are having with robotic surgery for radical prostate cancer surgery?
Not yet. The robotic or Da Vinci surgery for rectal cancer is really just starting. There are surgeons trying the technique, but we don't yet have data to show improved outcomes from robotic surgery for rectal cancer.
Okay. Well, then the question I really called in about was in the news lately, if you're looking at the net and you come on CNN or one of your web pages, one of Charlie's Angels had anal cancer, which is a rather uncommon tumor, and I wonder if you might just make some comments about that.
I sure would. Anal cancer is not one of the glamorous cancers, that's for sure, and it's probably something most people don't talk about. It is a type of skin cancer. The anus is lined by squamous epithelium, which is a type of the same type of skin cells we have on the rest of our body, and it is prone to the same type of skin cancer. So most anal cancers are actual squamous carcinomas, versus most colorectal cancers are glandular tumors known as adenocarcinomas. But the squamous carcinomas of the anus, while not being as common as colorectal cancer, it's certainly I would probably see a half dozen people a year here with anal cancer. The important thing to know about anal cancer is that it is highly curable if treated with chemotherapy and radiation before it is at an advanced stage. Very, very high cure rates, over 90%. So I would say for any patient who has symptoms on their anus, particularly if there's anything growing like a lump or a bump that is uncomfortable or bleeding, that it is absolutely important to get assessed, because while anal cancer is uncommon, it is highly curable if treated early.
Okay, thank you. Is there a risk factor for that, like human papillomavirus?
Yes, you hit the nail on the head. It is. It often is triggered by human papillomavirus. And many listeners will recognize the name human papillomavirus as the virus which is linked to cervical cancer in women. And there is now a vaccine, Gardasil, which is an anti-HPV or anti-human papillomavirus vaccine, which is highly effective in preventing the dysplasia on the cervix of women from HPV. And it probably is also going to decrease the incidence of anal cancer. So absolutely, there's an HPV role in anal cancer.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's take another question. I've got a number of issues that have come up from some of the conversation, but I want to make sure we get this other email. This is a lady who 17 years ago suffered a fourth-degree rectal tear, and you might want to describe that with the birth of her first child, and about 8 years ago had a spherectomy, she says, that repaired that tear. And although the surgeon felt comfortable that he or she had done a good job, the symptoms really have not improved and perhaps are even worse, with fecal leakage as her most prominent symptom, which clearly would be an issue with this lady. And she's wanting to know, what should she do? You guys now are colorectal surgeons up here. Can that be handled here? Should she go out? Are there people who do nothing but try to fix some post-operative problems like this that are very good at it? What's the best advice we can give her?
Well, this is both a large topic and a difficult topic. Fecal incontinence often is multifactorial, meaning that there are many causes contributing, and one of the big risk factors for fecal incontinence is childbirth, so obstetrical injury. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a fourth-degree tear, which implies that during a vaginal childbirth, a tear occurred through the vaginal wall, through the muscles separating the vagina and anorectal area, and actually tore into the anorectal area. So that is the most severe tear. They're graded from 1 to 4. So a grade 4 tear implies a fairly significant disruption of the normal anatomic structures in that area with childbirth. And part of the problem with fourth degree tears is not only do they tear through the normal supportive tissue and muscles, there tends to be with any childbirth, but particularly a childbirth that produces a fourth degree tear, stretching and damage to nerves in the pelvis known as pudendal nerves. So many of these women not only will have a muscular defect or an actual missing portion of muscle, they will also have damage to their nerves. And surgical treatment
that allow them to control the function of
correct,
their anus.
And, correct. Okay, okay. And, you know, when I talk to patients about this, I say, you know, you can fix the refrigerator, but if the electrical cord is cut,
yeah,
there's not a lot you can do. And unfortunately, yeah, we don't have any effective surgery for restoring nerve function. So part of the workup for fecal incontinence following obstetrical injury is often nerve testing, mm-hmm, to see if the nerves are damaged or not. I don't know the surgical history of this patient. You mentioned 17 years ago, and the operation that she probably had was a sphincteroplasty, mm-hmm, which means to fix the sphincter, and that implies there was a defect or a damage to the sphincter. And colorectal surgeons implied technique of trying to fix that that anatomic space to restore it. And it is unfortunately an operation that is not perfect. The anus after sphincteroplasty can be too tight, which is another set of problems entirely, or it can be too loose, or it can be the right tightness but still not work very well due to a combination of scarring and damage to the nerves. And we also have some scientific data now showing that the sphincteroplasty operation, unfortunately, even if it works, there tends to be some deterioration over time. So for a patient such as the woman you're describing, the best thing to do would be to go back and have another colorectal surgical evaluation to see if there's anything simple that can be done. And when I say simple, sometimes it is a situation where improving the consistency and frequency of the bowel movements is sometimes all that's required. If you take any normal, healthy person and they develop a bad gastroenteritis or they get severe diarrhea for whatever reason, fecal leakage will occur. And the more problems you have with injury to that area, the more likely that's to occur with loose stool. So there are dietary factors and conservative factors and other things that can be tried before you get back to repeat surgery for fecal incontinence.
K Can a exam and history by themselves answer some of the significant questions about whether there's residual nervous system injury? I'm thinking back to my anatomy that, you know, there is reflexes around the anus that when you stroke around the anus that usually may contract involuntarily at times. Are there ways that you can tell that? Or is this something better done maybe even with a gastrointestinal, some other specialist, looking at the best they can how the lower colon, rectal, anus is working?
Typically,
is there a big team that may need to be done to figure this out, or can a good colorectal surgeon figure out what's needed or what can't be done?
If you go to one of the major academic medical centers, the fecal incontinence clinics often are multidisciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll often have a gastroenterologist addressing the medical side of it to try and see if there's anything medical that can be done to mm-hmm. improve bowel movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then often you will have a physical therapist or someone working with Kegel-type exercises or pelvic floor exercises. You often have a motivated radiologist who's interested in this area who can perform either something called dynamic MRI testing or something called video defecography, where you take actual movie pictures basically of the defecation process to try and determine what is going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But usually the colorectal surgeon would be the front mm-hmm. specialist.
Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like it would be reasonable for this lady to get another opinion locally and then discussing options after that to see whether it makes sense to go outside.
Absolutely. And then there are other surgical options, which are the sort of advanced or end-stage options. And some of these are not available in Alaska. One of them is called sacral nerve stimulation. It's the implantation of a nerve stimulator, and that addresses the neurological component,
mm-hmm.
and it tries to re-innervate the anal sphincter, and there is some success with that technique. It's currently not available mm-hmm. outside of very few specialized centers which are running trials. And there are other techniques which involve either implantation of an artificial sphincter or taking muscle from another area of the body and using that to restore the sphincter. So there are a number of possible surgical techniques available either here in Alaska or outside.
And those many of these, I'm guessing, like medical therapies, are really under in somewhat of an investigational aspect to see if they really are better with less consequences, less side effects. And so there's ongoing studies of the outcomes of these surgeries. And that's one reason why it may be at a medical center?
Absolutely. And particularly when it involves the implantation of a medical device,
uh-huh.
such as a neurological stimulator, that is tightly regulated by mm-hmm. the FDA. And you're not allowed to implant a device into a patient unless it's proven scientifically to have benefit and have, you know, appropriate risk-benefit ratio.
Let me remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Mark Kemmons. He's a colorectal surgeon, has extensive training and experience. And if you've got questions or comments about any of the issues that you may hear today or symptoms that you may have that you may want to get his opinion on, call us at 550-8433, 550-8433, or toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and you can also reach us by email at lineone@kska.org. And remember, we're going to be here for another 15 or 20 minutes or so, and then everything's going to be taped rebroadcast. So if you've got questions, you want to do that now. Let's take something more simple: hemorrhoids. Anybody ever have a hemorrhoid? Must have questions about them. You get to see patients with hemorrhoids, and what do you start talking about, and what are the options?
Absolutely. One of the most common complaints I get coming through the door is the complaint of hemorrhoids in quotation marks. At least I put it in quotation marks because many of the problems are actually not hemorrhoids. But patients typically assume that anything in the anal area that is either hurting, itching, bleeding, or swelling is a hemorrhoid. But hemorrhoids are normal vascular structures that we're all born with, and we have enlarged blood vessels up inside the rectum. And we have them just under the skin of the anus, and the ones just up inside the lower rectum are called internal hemorrhoids, and they occur primarily in three different anatomic areas, and they communicate with the vessels on the outside. And so hemorrhoids typically will produce symptoms depending on whether you have enlargement of the internal hemorrhoids or the external hemorrhoids or both. Internal hemorrhoids don't have any sensory innervation, so the internal hemorrhoids by themselves cannot hurt. They can be uncomfortable, and they can cause irritation of the skin on the outside, but internal hemorrhoids by themselves don't hurt. They prolapse, which means they protrude through with bowel movements. Sometimes patients have to actually push them back up inside, and they tend to bleed because they are essentially like little bags of blood vessels that can be squished or burst when the bowel movement comes through. So bleeding and prolapse are typically the symptoms of internal hemorrhoids, which I would treat. And then associated external hemorrhoids stretch the skin on the outside of the anus, and if they develop a blood clot, that is often what people refer to as a hemorrhoid flare, and medically thrombosed external hemorrhoids, that produces a hard, firm, tender swelling on the outside of the anus, and so that would be an external, specifically external hemorrhoidal problem. And then, of course, some patients come in with prolapsing mixed internal and external hemorrhoids where everything is coming out and swollen and sore and bleeding, and those patients, often surgery is the only resort for them.
So what are the risk factors and what are the most common treatment options? Just to maybe describe a few, because we've suddenly got quite a few callers.
Sure. Well, with many things in surgery and with anorectal problems particularly, I usually start with the most simple things. And so I would take a dietary history, and oftentimes simply reducing things like coffee and increasing fiber will help reduce hemorrhoid symptoms. And a simple exam in the office to give me a baseline as to how big the hemorrhoids are, how much they're prolapsing, how much they're swollen, and whether there's any other associated findings determine on what the treatment algorithm will be.
Dok, let's take one of our callers. Joe, you're on line one.
Hi, thank you, doctor, for taking my call. In 2004, I was diagnosed with a pulled groin muscle, and I went to the doctor three or four times, and I went to the hospital a couple of times, and come to find out, it was a perforated colon in the backside of the colon.
Okay.
And I almost, they almost lost me. I had infection from my left kidney up to my shoulder and down into my leg. So they did the a general surgeon did the operation, and they had to medevac me to Seattle. And I woke up there with a bag on my side and all that stuff.
Okay.
And I was on life support and everything else. My body shut down with all this poison. And I did the takedown a year later.
Okay.
No, I don't own the bag anymore.
Right.
My question is, it was due to diverticulitis.
That's what I was going to guess.
Yeah. But anyway, what I'm asking you, am I now more prone to that or colon cancer? I've been doing colon, you know, the camera.
Right. Colonoscopy.
Every 5 years.
Yeah, good.
Should I do that more often, or is that okay? Or
that's okay.
Am I more prone?
No, a personal history of diverticulitis does not give you increased risk of colon cancer, but anybody who's had a perforated colon and is given a diagnosis of diverticulitis needs a colonoscopy to make sure that that was the correct diagnosis. So occasionally people are given a presumed diagnosis of diverticulitis based on colon symptoms, and it potentially could turn out to be something like a colon cancer. But if you've had colonoscopy, and particularly if you've then gone on to have follow-up colonoscopies, the history of diverticulitis itself would not necessarily give you any increased risk.
So every 5 years is a norm then?
Well, I think we're probably going to be talking about colorectal cancer prevention and screening in a minute, but the most important determinant of how often you should have colonoscopy is your own set of risk factors. And diverticulitis is not a risk factor for colorectal cancer, but your family history would be, and any previous presence of polyps on a colonoscopy would certainly help you determine your risk.
No, I didn't have any of that, so...
So yeah.
Okay, I was just wondering if I was now at a higher risk of...
Not just based on that history of diverticulitis, no.
Okay. Well, why would diverticulitis perforate your colon?
Well, the condition known as diverticulosis are little weak spots in your colon where the mucosal lining pokes through. if you can imagine a bicycle tire that has a weak spot and the inner tube is protruding through the weak spot on the bicycle tire, you could see how that little piece of inner tube might pop. And that's analogous to what happens in the colon. There are little sites along the colon where blood vessels perforate the wall and they create a little natural weakness. And over time, these little pockets or blisters of colon lining can protrude through that weak spot, and they can burst or rupture. And if they burst or rupture, they become inflamed and they stimulate inflammation outside the colon, and that is known as diverticulitis. And if the infection spreads beyond that local area, you can develop peritonitis and diffuse,
that's
and that's what it sounds like you had, right?
That's what I had, exactly, yeah. So just have normal checkups and...
That's right, and eat. They used to tell people who had any history of diverticulosis or diverticulitis that they were not permitted to eat seeds, strawberries, nuts, or popcorn. And
yeah.
I think a lot of people suffered unnecessarily because there's good data to show that what you want is a well-balanced diet with more fiber and that those things I mentioned are okay to eat as long as you do it in moderation.
Okay, because I like tomatoes.
Yeah, there you go. So enjoy your nice summer tomatoes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Doctor.
Okay. You're very welcome.
Thank
right.
you.
I can't help but mention, too many tomatoes will make you orange, though. So there's a, there's a pigment called carotene. It's a well-known
carrots
epidemiologically
too.
Story. Anyway, that's another show. Terrell, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thank you for taking my call. I have a personal history of breast cancer.
Okay.
And I've been told that colon cancer may be a higher risk in me, and I wonder how so. Also, my mother died of colorectal cancer, so they've advised me to get this genetic screening, and I wanted your comments perhaps on, you know, how is this related to
sure.
breast cancer? And then,
how old was your mother when she died?
She's 58.
Okay, 58. And how old are you? Do you mind me asking?
I'm 50.
Okay. Well, by your personal history of breast cancer, as well as your family history of colon cancer in a first-degree relative, you are in the moderate risk category for colorectal cancer. The reason that breast cancer and colorectal cancer are associated is there are certain genetic abnormalities that have been identified that predispose to both of those cancers. And if you were recommended genetic testing, it's possible that someone took a good family history and they identified the possibility that you're carrying one of the known genes. And the reason I asked how old your mother was is there's one of the genetic syndromes is known as HNPCC, what used to be called Lynch syndrome, or hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer syndrome, that is linked to genes where people develop colorectal cancer at a young age and other associated cancers. So that may be why genetic testing has been recommended. And if you were identified to carry one of those genes, you would actually be high risk and would be screened in a special high risk group. But you are at least moderate risk, and the current recommendation for moderate risk individuals is to start colorectal cancer screening with full colonoscopy by age 40 or 10 years younger than your affected relative, whichever comes first, and then you should have colonoscopy every 3 to 5 years. So if you are holding off having colonoscopy for any reason, I would strongly suggest that you hold off no longer, because you're definitely at elevated risk for colorectal cancer. And so would any of your brothers or sisters if they share the same mother.
Okay. Well, thank you for the comments, Doctor.
Yeah, let me make one more comment. We recently had a program on genetic counseling on the program, and Providence has a genetic counselor who could very well, very easily, I think, with some interview with you, give you a little bit more information of your options about testing and making sure you get the right testing done also. It's not necessarily true that all physicians would understand the exact way to go about doing that testing, and that's another reason maybe to think about that.
I would second that, absolutely, that they do an excellent job at Providence with their genetics counseling and screening, and definitely the genetic counselors are the ones who are in a position to best advise you on which genetic testing you should undergo.
Yeah, they have done a good job, and I really appreciate your comments.
Yeah, thanks very much for your call. Well, we haven't mentioned screening. We've only got about 7 or 8 minutes. So let's make sure we talk about, you've mentioned some very important issues to Terrell, who called about screening. What are the general recommendations about screening for colorectal cancer?
Well, I don't think colorectal cancer screening can be overemphasized or emphasized enough. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death for both men and women in the United States. Approximately 150,000 people are diagnosed with colorectal cancer every year, and approximately 50,000 Americans die from colorectal cancer every year. The good news is that colorectal cancer is one of the few cancers that can be truly prevented by removing precancerous growths called polyps. So the purpose of colorectal cancer prevention and screening is to identify polyps and remove them before they become cancer. So currently, the most important question you have to ask yourself is what your risk level is. And the last caller was moderate risk based on her history and her family's history. But if you have no identifiable risk factors, you are identified as average risk, and the current recommendations are to start screening at age 50. And if you are moderate risk, you would start at age 40 or 10 years younger than your affected relative, whichever comes first. And then there are some special high-risk groups, but usually that's pretty readily identified from a very strong family history. And those patients start even earlier. But it's important for people who have any family history not to delay colorectal cancer screening. And I will mention for adopted patients or people that if you are adopted, you usually do not know your biological family history. And I think it's safest to assume that you do have a family history of colorectal cancer in that case and start your screening as if you were moderate risk.
Dr. Kimmons, one of the things that's probably, I think, worth commenting on and then asking some opinion from you on is that before the program, I kind of looked at trends in the incidence of colorectal cancer and then mortality, those who are dying from this disease, and it's really surprised to me that over the last roughly 10 years that the incidence in most individual different races that we're looking at, the incidence has been decreasing by somewhere between 1 and almost 3% per year, and that the mortality has been decreasing even faster in many groups, up to 4% per year. When you see a decrease like that, I guess the thoughts that come to mind, there's maybe a change in the disease, the frequency, some prevention, but also in the care and early recognition and treatment. Is this a case where both is happening, or how would you explain, or what have you heard about, or perhaps the reasons for this change?
Well, we would like to think that we're making a difference by strongly emphasizing prevention and treatment, and I think most experts would say that at least a portion of the decrease is due to earlier detection and removal of polyps. When I started talking about colorectal cancer screening and prevention approximately 10 years ago, less than a third of Americans were being screened adequately, and now we are to approximately a half to 60%, so many more people are getting screened, and I think the topic of colorectal cancer is no longer taboo. People are talking about it. People are asking their relatives. And I think if you look at the stand-up comedians talking about colonoscopy, it is funny, but it's also, I think, a reflection that more people are getting the thing done and they're talking about it. There is potentially also lifestyle factors. I think there's more and more emphasis on weight loss and good nutrition and just overall health issues, which may be helping. Interestingly, there's a shift in the anatomical location of colorectal cancer over time. It used to be more common on the left side of the colon and the rectum, and currently it's more common in the right side of the colon, particularly in young people. And some of these things are as yet unexplained, but I think most specialists such as myself feel that this strong emphasis on prevention is starting to pay off.
Did you mention, when you were talking about the recommendations for screening, the primary screening mechanism seems to be the colonoscope?
Colonoscopy, yes.
Should we mention, or is it necessary to mention, any other screening techniques? I know sometimes there's just not enough bodies to get all colonoscopies, and what's the status on
that?
Well,
I think the status is that colonoscopy is the gold standard because it looks at your entire colon, and it is not only diagnostic, but it is therapeutic in that when you find a polyp, you can remove it. And unlike other screening tests, such as a virtual colonoscopy or a contrast study such as a barium enema, they may identify a polyp, but they can't remove it. So if you have a polyp found on one of those studies, then you have to get a colonoscopy in addition. One of the more popular screening tests in the past was flexible sigmoidoscopy, which was the so-called short scope, which was often done in the primary care doctor's office. It would only go in around the first couple of bends, a couple of feet, and it looked at the lower third of the colon and rectum. And the thought was that if you didn't have anything in that area, you were unlikely to have it higher up. And as I mentioned a moment ago, there's an anatomic shift towards polyps and cancers occurring more likely on the right side of the colon, which can only be reached with the colonoscope. So I do not know of any gastroenterologists or colorectal surgeons who are recommending flexible sigmoidoscopy as a gold standard screening test. Certainly it is better than nothing. And in an area where that's the only thing to do, a test for hidden blood in the stool, hemocult, plus a flexible sigmoidoscopy, plus to be safe, a barium enema or some type of contrast study to study the far side of the colon, which you can't reach with the colonoscope, would be absolutely better than no screening at all. But as of yet, the colonoscopy is the gold standard for colorectal cancer screening.
Okay, no. We have just a couple of minutes left. I think I'd like to end with just asking you to comment on anything that you think we might mention, need to mention, or the most common messages you want to leave our listeners with, since most of us only remember a couple of things when we're all said and done listening to talks like this.
Well, I would say if there's going to be one take-home message, it's the one I keep emphasizing, which is to get screened for colorectal cancer and to know your risk factors and apply them to appropriate screening. I think the second take-home message I would like to get out is that anorectal problems are extremely common. I would say most people have pain or bleeding or other problems around their anal area at one or another time during their life, and there is help for those problems. I see patients who have lived with pain and bleeding in that area for years and years and years and were unaware that there was anybody either trained or interested enough to manage that area of the body, and it certainly is available. So I would like to stress that.
You know, and for those of you who may have questions or want to develop a little bit further understanding about some of the topics today, if you go to line one, OKSKA.org, line one, and look at today's program notes, there are some web resources that will get you to some reliable sites on more information. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Mark Kemmons. It's been a delightful and very educational and I think an extremely reliable bit of information. We appreciate your time.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me here.
We'll have to do this again.
Wonderful. I'd love to.
Next week, we're going to return and we're going to be talking about autism. If there's one area of medicine where there's been a lot of confusing information of late, I think this is it. So Dr. Cowan is the medical director of the autism program at Children's Hospital in Seattle, and our efforts next week will be to kind of separate the science from the pseudoscience and heresy that is being brought about, particularly related to autism and its causes. So if you have an interest in that and you have friends or relatives that might want to know more about autism, I strongly urge you to listen next week. We will be back Monday, April 20th at our usual time, 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat each Monday at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, and you can go to our website to hear the podcasts, our prior podcasts, at any time. For KSKA and for Line One, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line One, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.